demand for services is going to continue to increase and outpace goods going forward. And what that could mean is that there could be hundreds of billions of dollars of PCE that needs to shift back from goods to services. And so that would have implications for goods-focused businesses, e-com players, etc.
Welcome to Recession Proof, a podcast by Ramp. Join us for in-depth, thought-provoking conversations with finance leaders, executives, and investors on the current state of the market and what this means for your business through 2022 and beyond. I'm your host, Alex Song. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks, Alex. Great to be here. Thanks for having me and look forward to having a good discussion.
Absolutely. So today's episode is going to be a little different. As you probably know, our podcast here at Ramp, we generally focus on interviewing practitioners, a few investors, a few entrepreneurs and whatnot. But in today's episode, we're joined by Ken. Ken Sahotsky is an equity research analyst at Autonomous Research. And we are very, very glad and very fortunate to have you. And I know that we're going to have a lot to talk about. We're going to talk about probably corporate spend. Obviously, we'll talk about potentially recession planning, macro indicators. And obviously, we also just want to hear a little bit more just about the life of a research analyst. And so I think a lot of that is going to be very, very interesting to some of our listeners. So really good to have you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Looking forward to it. And hopefully all the listeners can take something away from this conversation.
So Ken, to start, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, how you found your way into this particular industry, your career path, and also a little bit about Autonomous Research?
Yeah, absolutely, Alex. So I graduated from Middlebury College in 2011. I actually started working out at an investment management firm in New York called First Eagle Investment Management. It's a very value-focused firm. And I actually started out in a role that was in between research and sales. And through that experience, I was able to listen to analysts and portfolio managers at First Eagle talk about businesses, talk about industries in which they operate. And I really just got hooked. And so I love trying to figure out what makes a good business, you know, looking at the returns on capital, the margins, the growth opportunity, and more broadly, how these businesses can survive the test of time and sustain a competitive advantage. And so I started working in their family office for some time and then transitioned into equity research. And so I found myself at Autonomous at the end of 2015. So I've been with the firm for about 7 years now. You know, initially I was supporting two senior analysts. I've transitioned from that associate role to more of an analyst role over time. And now I cover various subsectors within payments, from the networks to merchant acquirers to B2B companies, which I'm sure we'll talk about more going forward. In terms of Autonomous Research, so Autonomous Research, we're an independent equity research firm. So we service the top, call it 200 investment management firms and hedge funds in the US. And the goal is really to partner with those clients and help them analyze companies, industries in which they operate, emerging trends. Autonomous was actually founded during the financial crisis. One of the top ranked financials analyst at the time, a guy by the name of Stuart Graham, worked at Bank of America. He decided to start his own firm. He took some of the best talent with him and quickly had success. So they launched in Europe in 2009. They expanded into the US in 2012. And really what he wanted to create, Alex, was this independent research shop. So we don't do any M&A advisory work, which allows us to publish on things like executive compensation, for example. And actually on that point, the CFO of one of our companies that we cover, I'm not going to name any names, actually called us about an hour after we published a report on synergy-related compensation. But we're free to publish on a wide range of topics. And that really attracted me to the firm. So we focus specifically on financial services companies. So we cover banks, insurance companies, asset managers, et cetera. My team, or a team of four, we cover the payments and a fintech subsector within financial services. And we, you know this, we host meetings with different companies in the fintech space, and we write research on them. So that's a little bit about my background. Oh, one other thing I should mention. Autonomous Research was acquired by AllianceBernstein back in 2019. You know, so we're part of the Sanford C. Bernstein Research Group, but we maintain our separate brands. So yeah, that's a brief overview of my background in autonomous research and how we fit into the world of payments.
So let me ask you this. Is the difference between, let's say, you guys and maybe someone like Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs Research, is the idea that because they're not independent, right? They do have a, you know, broker dealer, they do M&A advisory, stuff like that. From what I understand, whenever there's a transaction, an analyst who works at one of these firms literally has to, you know, stop coverage, right? And then after the transaction, whatever it may be, maybe an IPO or whatever, then they have to wait like a quiet period before they publish. Is that kind of the main difference between those folks and you guys?
I think that's, yeah, it's a great point, Alex. So that is one of the main differences, I think, right? Us being, you know, our roots are in independent research, right? So we could, first, we could write on essentially whatever we find interesting, right? Whether that's public companies or private companies. We just wrote a deep dive on Stripe recently, looking at the business and understanding where it fits into the payments ecosystem. Those big banks, they can't actually publish pre-IPO research, right? So that is one area of differentiation. I think our focus on financial services is another thing that differentiates us. So we sit, you know, within our New York office, we sit across the research team, we sit within 20 yards of each other, right? And so we're sharing ideas, working closely with each other. We collaborate. So one example would just be, you know, the banks, for example, reported their, had their earnings updates last week and early this week. And so one thing that we look at is making sure that we're understanding the payment volume trends across the different banks. And so we could work closely with our banks team to understand that. But yeah, I think the lack of a conflict of interest is really important because our clients know that we're giving them our honest opinion. Whereas I think in some cases, the research could be influenced by, you know, investment banking initiatives.
And then kind of putting kind of my practitioner's hat on, right? Let's see. I obviously have interacted in the past with investment analysts and research analysts and whatnot. Look at it from your perspective. When you're out there meeting management teams or you're meeting some of these operators and founders and entrepreneurs, who exactly are the people that you're seeing? Is there a specific persona? Is it typically investor relations or does it go all the way to a CRO or a CMO? Like who are you actually in front of day to day when you're getting to know a team?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question. I think, you know, if we're trying to break into a new company and try to understand that business, it's really anyone that would allow us an in into that company. So I think it varies, right? That first point of contact, I think, varies a little bit more than the established companies. But then, yeah, we're usually engaging with investor relations or somebody who is, you know, maybe heading up the strategy team, for example, if we're really trying to understand the business and where that business fits into the industry. You know, sometimes if it's a really early stage company, Alex, we'll get put in touch with the CFO or the CEO, right? Because they're still kind of handling some of those meetings, some of those communications. So I think it really varies. I mean, for the really large private companies, I think it's hard to get in touch with their management teams relative to these smaller companies. Yeah, but at the end of the day, we're really trying to understand the business. So whether that's a CRO, a CEO, or the head of sales, you know, any way we could really understand that business and learn more about the business, it would be super helpful to us.
Yeah, understood. Pivoting the conversation a little bit, and we definitely were going to get to this at some point. Let's talk about the macro. Are we in a recession? What's going on here? Obviously, you know, we see a lot of this firsthand with respect to our customers and corporate spend and some of these things. But from your perspective, you obviously see a lot of data points, both on the macro front as well as on the corporate front. Do you have a take? Is there a house take and is there a can take?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I first off, I think I have to say that we're bottom up investors, but I think understanding the macro is becoming increasingly important. And so you know, we're not trying to forecast the macro precisely down to the second decimal point or anything like that. But we do follow the macro. And so I think it's probably important, Alex, to separate, I guess, what we're seeing in terms of current indicators versus what we might see in the future. And so what I mean by that is, you know, things are chugging along at the moment. And what we hear from a lot of companies is that there's stability, right, in spending, there's resiliency. But I mean, we may see the macro slow down a little bit over the long term. So let me just unpack this a little bit. So in the near term, what we see, there's excess savings, there's wage growth that remains robust, debt servicing for consumers remains in check. I mentioned the U.S. banks reporting volumes last week. They grew volumes 11% year over year this last quarter, so still fairly robust on a year over year basis. Credit volume growth continues to outpace debit volume growth. And so that's just the normalization of some of the mix shift that we saw during COVID. On the other hand, I think even the banks are in disagreement over their economic outlooks, right? And so, for example, I don't know if you listened to the JP Morgan call, but Jamie Dimon has been sounding the alarms ever since our Bernstein Strategic Decisions Conference back in June, because he's been talking about a hurricane coming to the US economy. Whereas Bank of America, they were pretty upbeat this quarter. And so, you know, messages are mixed, I would say. What we're seeing is increased layoffs across tech companies, and companies more broadly are pulling back from hiring as well. And so when we talk to investors, I think there's a lot of concern about the potential for a so-called white collar recession, right? And so, and then we look at some of the retail sales data, Alex. We're seeing some deceleration in real growth. So if you strip out the inflation benefit, you're seeing real growth decelerate after a period of above trend growth. Another headwind that we're tracking potentially is this shift from goods back to services. And so what's happening here is, you know, pre-pandemic, the percentage of PCE that was goods related was about 31%, right? Pre-pandemic is pretty stable. That's increased to about 34% or so recently. And so we're going to have to see some normalization of that over the coming years. And so I think demand for services is going to continue to increase and outpace goods going forward. And what that could mean is that there could be hundreds of billions of dollars of PCE that needs to shift back from goods to services. And so that would have implications for goods-focused businesses, e-com players, et cetera. So it's a mixed picture in the U.S., I would say. Outside the U.S., things don't look as encouraging, right? So you look at trends out of the U.K. and Europe. I mean, it looks like economic activity has come to a halt there. And so all in, I think our view is that the U.S. is, I mean, it's the way I describe it is probably the prettiest house in a very ugly neighborhood.
That's fascinating. There's a lot to unpack there. There's definitely a lot to unpack there. I think the first thing is we actually do see some of these macro currents in our internal spend data as well. I mean, I know that you and I have jammed in recent weeks about our quarterly spend report, in which we break down, you know, by segment, by industry, by merchant composition, sort of the evolution of spend, corporate spend over the last couple of quarters. And I actually think a lot of those trends that you just discussed certainly is apparent in our data as well. I mean, I think one thing to note is actually with respect to, you know, a pocket of weakness, I think hardware spend, right? We certainly saw that over the last actually two quarters in a row, where I think maybe some folks were a little bit more tepid about hiring and adding headcount. And a proxy for that is simply how many laptops are you buying? How much, you know, electronics and hardware are you purchasing? And we definitely did see that as, you know, one area where where there was, you know, a little bit of a tempering in spend. Whereas I think in some other areas, services, for example, some of the areas that you spoke of, there was definitely some continued strength there across the various segments.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, I think my view, Alex, is that, you know, in this time of uncertainty, businesses do need to put more of their spending under scrutiny, right? And if you're facing inflationary pressures and your costs are going up, you know, you need to be able to manage that. And so I think that's what we're seeing and we're hearing when we talk to companies. I mean, even our own company, we couldn't send everyone out to Money 2020. I know we're going to see you out in Money 2020 next week, but we couldn't send everyone out there. And so I think these businesses are kind of tightening up their budgets a little bit more and being careful kind of when it comes to spending. And then I think there's just a broader uncertainty in the market. And so, yeah, I think some of the trends that we've seen is the number of jobs or job openings in the economy that has come down, right? With some of those layoffs, businesses pulling out those additional spots. And so you could have the labor market normalizing a little bit here.
Yeah. Normalizing is a good way of putting it, because obviously we have lived through several years of sort of historically tight labor markets. I think labor shortages up and down, you know, the various different industries, whether it's blue collar, white collar services, manufacturing, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I think normalization is probably a good way to describe it. But that actually is a good segue for another topic I want to do a little bit of a deep dive on, which is inflation. So, you know, I think inflation is kind of interesting because we're kind of in an interesting kind of state of the world. There is a lot of inflation. There are a lot of people who are in camp transitory. So maybe it'll be there in a few months or a few quarters from now. Maybe it won't. And it's also interesting because the Fed is tightening, you know, maybe as they should be. If you want to fight inflation, that's your thing. That's what you got to do. And in addition to that, you also have, you know, simultaneously, you know, this really strong labor market and everything. Sentiment seems to be, you know, kind of weak, but then there's some fundamental strength in the labor market. What is your take around just the how inflation is kind of percolating through its way through the economy?
It's a great question. I mean, what we're seeing right now is, I mean, you're seeing it everywhere, right? I mean, you're seeing it in food inflation, core inflation is elevated, remains elevated. You're seeing companies talk about wage pressures, Alex. So the companies that we cover, they're having to reset their budgets higher when it comes to maintaining their personnel and making sure their employees are taken care of. We're seeing it in infrastructure, right? And networking costs. So things that payment companies and fintech companies rely on to run their businesses. And so, you know, I think the one thing, you know, our view on inflation is that it's really not good for any business, but payment companies are generally better positioned to face inflationary periods, at least when compared to companies that are outside of the, you know, the financial services sector.
And when you say payments, you just mean, you know, if you're in the business of processing payments, inflation probably helps you at least somewhat because just the ticket sizes are larger, right? Somebody buys something that was a dollar yesterday, today it's $1.08, right? Because of, you know, inflation. And because of that, a payments business makes its money through take rates and whatnot. And, you know, as a processor, and because of that, we're basically almost resetting your revenue base in tandem to inflation. Is that sort of what you mean?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And one point before I comment on that, I think like what's going to be interesting to see how this plays out is, you know, do these inflation expectations get anchored across the economy? And does that lead to persistent inflation? Because if that happens, then I think that becomes more problematic for a lot of companies in the market. Whereas I think expectations are for inflation to kind of come down. And there's long-term deflationary forces at play here, whether it's slowing population growth or, you know, lower productivity growth because companies are reinvesting less. So I think longer term, you know, we'll see how that plays out. But I think payments and fintech, it's a good place to be if you're concerned about inflation. I think you hit the nail on the head, Alex, where, I mean, these companies usually generate revenue as a percentage of the transaction value, right? So as the average transaction size increases due to the inflation, if you're charging a take rate, if you're charging 2% on whatever that transaction value is, you know, your revenues are going to go up as that transaction size goes up. I think there's a couple other key points to think about here when it comes to which businesses might be in a better position to survive an inflationary environment. And it's companies that have pricing power because of some reason, whether it's a strong franchise or you have a dominant position in the industry. And so as their expenses increase, you know, they can raise price to make sure that their revenues increase and maintain their earnings power of the business. That's extremely important. And then third, most payment companies are capital light business models, right? With high returns on capital. So you don't need a lot of tangible capital to run your business, right? You're not going out and buying a manufacturing facility or a factory to produce goods, right? And that's really important because when costs go up, these manufacturing companies, they have to put out additional dollars to buy that factory. So that's another benefit that the payment companies have. So overall, I think inflation is bad for pretty much every company in the long run. But, you know, in the near term, I think it just depends how much you can survive that environment.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, certainly, I think on the expense front, I mean, I think everyone's seeing it. We're certainly seeing it. Everything from contractors to even how much we're paying our auditors to, you know, various service providers. Obviously, everyone's, you're at the next refresh cycle and all of a sudden it's like, hey, guys, wages are up, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8% year over year. We got to rethink the contract, right? And so definitely, it's probably something that a lot of our listeners, a lot of folks are managing through right about now.
Yeah, totally. And I think it also, like, that's an important point because I think some companies, they might benefit from inflation because average ticket prices are going up. Other companies have longer term contracts. You know, in some cases, they have inflation escalators, Alex, where the revenue that they generate from those contracts are automatically resetting higher based off of some inflation index that they track. So while other companies didn't have that in place, so I think, you know, that's something that we might see as well. If you aren't generating a fee based off of the transaction size, maybe there's some lock or some clause that you could put into your contracts to insulate you a little bit.
Yep. Are there any other, and this doesn't have to be inflation, it could just be macro or just corporate performance. Obviously, you know, we're all inundated every day with headlines and corporate earnings and everything else that's coming. Are there any indicators that you like that you would consider to be a bellwether or, you know, something of a leading indicator that you pay a lot of attention to?
Yeah, I mean, leading indicators, I mean, we try to track, you know, real-time spending data sets. The large payment companies like Visa, MasterCard have actually provided certain data sets along those lines. So you get a sense.
They do the monthly reports, right?
That's exactly right. So we look at the monthly trends. You know, how are those developing? I think one thing to keep in mind, if you think about the health of the consumer, it's they have an income statement, right? It's their revenue minus their cost. So if you break that down a little bit, I mean, their revenues are going to be the paycheck that they're getting from their employer. If unemployment ticks up, that's going to be a problem in terms of consumer spending. I think if inflation persists, you're going to see costs rising. And so that's going to squeeze the consumer potentially, unless they're offsetting that with higher revenue. I think, and you could get some commentary out of the banks. So JP Morgan was talking about, I think their expectation, Alex, is for consumers to exhaust some of the excess savings that have been in their accounts from all the stimulus-related payments during COVID sometime next year. And I think they said by the middle of next year. Bank of America has been pretty optimistic about the health of the consumer. So I think, you know, those are things that you could look at to try to get a sense for how this might play out. But yeah, I think like the balance sheets of a lot of these consumers were certainly helped by the excess stimulus payments and the stimulus payments that were provided during COVID. You know, but we'll see. We'll see how it plays out. I think in certain economies, I think the consumer is going to be in a tougher position. Like in the UK, for example, where inflation is higher than the US. And apparently, like, I think 40% of the mortgages in the UK are variable rate versus 20%, I think, in the US. So in the UK, you're getting squeezed on, you know, not just your kind of core inflation, but also your housing costs. So we might have another leg up in terms of expense growth for certain economies like the UK come next year.
And not only the adjustable rate mortgages, but also I think the utility, right? Utility, gas, heating, et cetera. I think folks are paying anywhere between 4, 5, 6x what they were paying on a run rate basis last year, which is interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel sorry for our colleagues in the UK, you know, because we do have a UK office. So hopefully that doesn't come to the US.
Yeah. One other area, kind of a similar note, is, you know, as you probably know, we, you know, this is some of the secret sauce here at Ramp, but basically we keep pretty close track of, you know, the cross section between where folks come from and where they spend. And we keep track of, I guess, something along the lines of a same store sales concept. We kind of rigorously go through that and we go through the different segments in the industries. And we also track how obviously these trends are evolving. And across the different industries, I think there's probably 5 or 6 buckets where actually we've seen maybe 6, if not more, consecutive months of almost consecutive growth in same store sales. And as you can probably guess, these are all T&E related buckets. Parking, gas, fuel, hotels, airfare, lodging, and whatnot, kind of just 6 straight months of, and I think very few other buckets saw that much strength, right? I think other buckets, you'll have a lot, you know, some seasonal ups and downs, and some months you'll see pluses and minuses. But I think T&E inflation is a topic that seems to be very top of mind right now. What gives? What's the reason for that? You know, I think oil prices maybe can explain some of it, but why would a hotel room be more expensive, you know, now than it was 6 months ago or a year ago?
Yeah, listen, it's a good question. I mean, I think it just comes back to supply and demand. There's been so much pent up demand, and we see it in a lot of the data that we track, right? Whether it's passenger traffic in the top 10 airports in Europe or the TSA. Passenger numbers in the U.S. They actually closed some of the, they put a cap on the number of passengers in certain European airports just because they couldn't handle that demand. So I think it really just comes down to, I mean, everyone was locked in their house for basically a year, 2 years. You had this excess savings because you couldn't go out and really spend it. I mean, you spent some of it online. But so now you have an economy that's reopening. You have borders that are reopening. And people want to go out and travel and move around and experience things. So I think you're seeing that shift back to services that's been in place for some time. Yeah, and it's more, I think what we're seeing is the spend in, you know, the discretionary services was certainly there, right? Whether it's lodging, you know, travel and entertainment, restaurant sales, we're seeing strong demand there. So those are the categories that are seeing that demand, but they're also the categories that might pull back quickly if we go into some sort of downturn.
Maybe like switching gears a little bit, and maybe let's pivot the discussion a little bit more specifically to, you know, fintech companies and kind of your coverage of the space. Obviously, saw that you guys had initiated coverage of Stripe, which is really cool, really interesting. They're, you know, a partner of ours, obviously, but would be very curious to hear what was the impetus for that. And, you know, obviously you guys cover public companies, but now you also cover some privates. Is there a particular reason for that? Are clients asking you about them? Or is there another reason why you know, just decided to pick up coverage of some of these private companies?
Yeah, it's a great question. So yeah, that's one of the things that is, it's one of the nice things about working at Autonomous, because we're able to publish on private companies like Stripe, like you mentioned, Alex. And you know, we don't have official coverage of Stripe. It's more of, we call it a primer on the company. So helping our clients better understand what is Stripe, what's the business, et cetera. I think it's becoming increasingly important for our clients and investors more broadly to understand these private companies. I think, you know, one of the reasons we wrote about it is because Stripe had $100 billion valuation, right? Just last year, I think it was. And so that's a really big company in the payments and fintech space. I mean, it's bigger than a lot of the public companies that are out there. But in terms of understanding it, why we want to understand it, you know, first, if we're an investor and we're following the space, I mean, you want to understand the competitive landscape well, right? Which is impossible without understanding all the competitors, whether they are incumbents or disruptors. And so, you know, this is particularly true for payments, right? Every public payment company out there, it just seems like for every company out there, it seems like there's another one that's private. And so I think, you know, that's important to understand. You know, in the B2B space, for example, there's a few public companies out there, but many of the competitors like Ramp, for example, you're still private, right? So we have to get to know you a little bit more. And then I think one trend that we're seeing, Alex, is private companies are now staying private for longer, meaning that, you know, by learning about them, well, if you don't learn about them, you might miss out on truly understanding how some of the larger players operate, not just the startups or the early disruptors. And then lastly, I mean, this has implications for the public companies, right? We've seen private companies like Stripe take share from some of the publics over time, right? And so I think as investors, it's truly important to understand why that's happening and how that impacts the competitive landscape. That's why, I mean, the Ramp benchmarking report is extremely helpful, right? Because we can learn more about your business. We can understand where you fit into the ecosystem. So thank you to you and your team for putting that together. That was super helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. It is interesting. I mean, obviously with just over the last, I would say, half decade, if not decade, right, more and more public markets focused hedge funds have, or just public markets investors overall, have become crossover investors. And now they look at more private deals, private companies, private opportunities. And I think probably due to many of the trends that you just noted just now. It's an interesting observation because obviously sometimes, right, people can come in with different, just how they think about the company, different investment frameworks. Are people more prone to calling the quarter and trading on very high frequency indicators? Or are some other folks more like, yes, I have 5, 7, 10-year holds, and I just want to understand the business model. I think just seeing the diversity in investment frameworks has been very, very interesting to me.
Yeah, I think that's spot on, Alex. I mean, you could have a shorter term investor who's looking to get the latest trends, right, out of your business so they can use that as a read through to other companies. Or you might have a long term investor who looks out 10 to 20 years that is really trying to understand the business. Can this be a company that gains market share over the next decade and build a solid franchise and become a, you know, 20, 30, 40, $50 billion company over time? So, you know, there's different perspectives. We get to interact with both types of investors. You know, so yeah, it's certainly interesting. But yeah, the private space is becoming more popular. I think some of that too is just the amount of capital that has flowed into private equity, right? There's a lot of capital there. I think there's still a lot of dry powder, and we're already seeing companies get gobbled up, right? Company like Billtrust that was acquired for, I think it was around $2 billion, maybe a little bit more. I think it was like 10, 11 times gross profit for that asset. And so I think as these valuations have come down, I think you'll probably see more, you know, private equity companies stepping in.
Putting my practitioner's hat back on. All right. So as, you know, a management team, I think there are probably a few things that are top of mind, right, when navigating through potential recession or macro volatility and whatnot. So two questions for you, not to put you on the spot, but two questions for you. So, you know, you look at a lot of companies, there's a lot in your coverage universe. Question number one is, you know, what defines a good management team? When you look at some of these companies that you cover, you've gotten to know some of them for years and years, I'm sure. What are some of the characteristics of just a good, solid management team? That's question one. Question two is, notwithstanding, you know, are these people good or bad, what should folks be doing now in 2022? You know, is it share buybacks? Is it cost cutting? Is it all of the above? You know, functionally, what should be on the roadmap for some of these management teams? So two-part question. I know that it's kind of a complex and very nuanced subject, but would love to hear your perspective on this, just because I'm sure you come across tons of these folks just through work.
Totally. Yeah. So that's a great couple questions there, Alex. So I would say, so what makes a good management team? I mean, so you have a business that is producing cash flow, right? I think the management team is responsible for being stewards of allocating that cash flow and the earnings that the business generates. So when looking at a business, you want, from the investor side, you really want a management team that you can trust in doing the right thing. And what I mean by doing the right thing is, you know, allocating that cash flow that's being generated to high return projects, you know, whether that's expanding organically into new product categories or new geographies, or maybe doing acquisitions if it makes sense and it's done at the right price. You want a management team that you can trust at the end of the day. You want a management team that could foster a really attractive culture, right? So I think there's certain payment companies that have really good cultures and employees want to work there, right? That's another thing I think that's becoming important, at least the last couple of years, is how do you build a good culture, a good business where you're going to attract talent? So that's been very important, but that's what I would say. And there's different ways to gauge if management has done the right thing, at least from the public side. And that's looking at how have they allocated capital over time? How have they treated their shareholders? Are they buying back their stock at reasonable prices? You know, do they run the business with a lot of leverage? Do they own some ownership of the business where their incentives are aligned with equity holders? So those are a lot of the things that we look for as from the investing side. In terms of what management teams should be doing now, I think most companies in this environment, this macro uncertainty, I think you should be focusing on cash preservation and expense management, right? Which seems reasonable, and not to preach to the choir, but this could actually be a really good opportunity for spend management and back office automation companies, right? As they can pitch the excess savings to the C-suite. And I think it's just going to be you should have an easier sell now than before, right? Especially if there's wage inflation, that trade-off, the unit economics actually look more attractive. So I don't know. So I think you try to find areas within the business where you can not only take out a good chunk of the expense base, but you can also increase productivity, right? So focusing on things like spend management, AP automation and the like. And then, so you get the immediate savings, and then you can actually have those employees transition into more higher ROIC functions, right? More important functions, whether it's cash flow forecasting, et cetera. And then I think secondly, while times are uncertain, I think for the public companies, buying back stock in the public markets can make sense if your intrinsic value is above the current stock price, or potentially expanding through M&A, et cetera. You know, there's a really good book, Alex, if you wanted to read, I suggest your listeners to read it too, but there's a book called The Outsiders by William Thorndike, who talks about...
Love that book.
It's a great book. Talks about 8 unconventional CEOs and how they've created value for shareholders over time. And there are different blueprints for success, right? Some companies have done really well repurchasing stock with their excess free cash flow, while others have issued equity to buy other companies if their stock is expensive, right? So there's different ways to create value. That's one recommendation I would give to your listeners.
Yeah, interesting. So play that back. It sounds like obviously focus on, you know, key operating metrics, focus on ROIC, potential cost cutting, improvements in efficiency, and just making sure that, you know, you're cognizant of that. But one thing I actually did want to ask you about, and this has come up quite a bit when you know, I speak to other CFOs or other customers of ours, actually, this actually has been coming up quite a bit, which is ability to forecast. Ability to forecast right now is just a very fraught topic, just because I think everyone is reforecasting. No one has any idea what the economy is going to do. I think there's probably just incrementally probably more uncertainty or more volatility in assumptions. And so I actually want to put that question to you is, one, is stability of earnings intrinsically a good thing for investors? Is this something that's valuable that people look for? And two, are investors a little bit more forgiving at a time like this when, you know, you don't necessarily know what's going to happen with recession, not recession, high inflation, transitory or not? What does that, you know, say? What does that mean? Because a lot of companies obviously offer guidance, right? So does the confidence interval of the guidance, does that impact how you view, you know, a management team or a CFO or a company?
Those are great questions, Alex. So I would say, listen, I think stability is better than volatility, right? When you think about, you know, if you have a business, I mean, just any cash flow that's more stable I think is going to be valued more than a cash flow that is more volatile, assuming the growth rates at the end of the day are similar in the long run. I think if you have stable cash flows and earnings, you could take advantage of macro times of macro uncertainty. And so what I mean by that is, if you're a business that generates strong cash flow and you have a downturn and a clean balance sheet, you're not worried about going out of business, right? You can actually put some of that capital to work, whether it's buying out your competitors, improving your market position, you know, potentially raising price if you have a nice franchise. So there's different things that you can do if you have that stable earnings and stable cash flow. The second part, I just forgot your second part of the question. It was on the confidence.
Right, the confidence interval of guidance, or are people more forgiving, you know, during macro volatility around the guidance?
Yeah, listen, I think a couple things. One is, you know, in a investors like to see management teams that are realistic, right, and honest with their investors. So you don't want a management team that is sandbagging the guidance. You don't want a management team that's super aggressive in the guidance. You know, you can look historically and see how management has guided and how the business has performed relative to that. I think anytime there's a wider range of outcomes, that just means more uncertainty. Management doesn't know how the business is going to perform. But for a good business, that's okay, right? Because again, going back, if they could deploy some of that excess free cash flow in times of uncertainty, they can actually strengthen their position in the market and come out of this downturn even stronger. You know, so yeah, there's debates, I think, from investors as to whether or not companies should guide or shouldn't guide. But at the end of the day, there's a range of outcomes, and we're trying to guess what that potential range of outcomes is. Management teams are trying to do the same, right? So I think that's something that we'll see how they guide. My guess is that a lot of these companies will say, you know, our macro assumptions are X, Y, and Z, and this is how we think about what the results could be for 2023, for example.
Yeah, that's stellar. It's just been one of those things. I mean, it was never that sexy until, you know, now everyone talks about it, right? Everyone I'm talking to is thinking about forecasting and is thinking about how I can make sure that I can navigate, you know, my company through the coming months and quarters. And, you know, folks are looking at metrics that they've never really had to pay attention to before. Now, by the way, I'm telling folks with debt on the balance sheet, debt service coverage ratio. I mean, you got to start tracking your DSCR. If you weren't already doing that, you should definitely start doing that going forward, just so you can match assets versus liabilities and manage cash flow.
Totally. I think this environment is creating a lot of uncertainty. It's creating a lot of volatility, whether it's in interest rates or FX rates, right? If you look at the British pound or the euro, right, they're at almost historical lows versus the US dollar. I think it becomes tricky in this environment. And so one thing that we did recently, Alex, I don't know if a lot of payment and fintech investors, at least a lot in the public markets, look closely at the balance sheet, especially of these incumbents, right? Because it's like, you don't necessarily need to understand, like they're well within range of the debt service coverage ratios. Their net debt to EBITDAs are not breaching covenants. But what's happened recently is that some of these companies have variable rate debt on their balance sheets. And so interest rates have gone from 50 basis points up to 400 basis points. And so their interest expense is increasing. And so, you know, a lot of investors that we speak to have had to sharpen their pencils when it comes to understanding the balance sheet, understanding how these variables are going to impact the performance of the business. So yeah, and it's making, I think, everyone's lives tougher, not just investors, but, you know, management teams as well.
I don't want to leave this podcast on a completely pessimistic note, but here's a question I try to ask all of our guests, which is, you know, in the midst of all of this, you know, macro volatility and whatnot, are there any things that you're personally optimistic about kind of going into the rest of the year and into next year, you know, whether about the economy, professionally wise, companies in your coverage universe, or even personally, anything that you're especially optimistic about?
Yeah, I think, listen, I think for our companies, we're lucky enough, I think, to cover a subsector within financial services that is a growth industry, right? There's a lot of secular tailwinds when it comes to payments. You know, so that's one thing that we're really excited about, that these are good companies that they will become bigger businesses over time. There's a lot of interest from investors. And these are high quality companies that, you know, should compound over time. So I'm excited about the long-term opportunity. There are always bumps in the road. And so I think with that comes opportunity, both for our companies, but both for us to try to, you know, help tease out who's gaining market share, who's not, which businesses are coming out stronger rather than weaker. So I think volatility creates opportunity, not only for us, but the companies we cover. And then, yeah, listen, personally, I'm excited to get back to traveling a little bit. My wife and I, we were supposed to go on our honeymoon back in 2020, and it got postponed a few years. So we still haven't gone on our safari. So I'm hoping we can do that next year. So I'm excited about that.
Well, Ken, it's really good to have you on the podcast. I will say I've had a tremendous experience just, you know, getting to know you, talking to you, comparing notes with you around the industry over the last, you know, year, and really admire how articulate you are. Love reading your research. I think your clarity of thought and all of your insights and your research reports have been tremendous. And it helps me a lot in terms of thinking about how I can manage my, you know, kind of own financial reporting, how I think about capital allocation and whatnot. So I have been looking forward to this podcast and this recording for quite some time. And it's been absolutely tremendous having you here.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks so much, Alex. I really appreciate the kind words. And I echo a lot of those comments. You know, it's been great to meet you and interact with you over the last couple of years. And you'll look forward to doing more of that in the near future, because we'll see you at Money 2020 next week.
There you go. Looking forward to it. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Alex. Take care.
Recession Proof is brought to you by Ramp. To find out more about Ramp and how we can help you control spend, save time, and automate busy work, visit ramp.com. And then make sure to search for Recession Proof in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, or anywhere else podcasts are found. Make sure to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. On behalf of the team here at Ramp, thanks for listening.